Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to the Wild Tales podcast. I'm Jason Fox, and this series is all about adventure, resilience, and inspirational humans. The podcast is presented by The Book of Man and in partnership with Talisker, the single malt whiskey made by the sea. My guest today is Nims Di Perger, better known as Nims, an incredible mountaineer who last year made headlines when he climbed the 14 highest mountains in the world in under 7 months. He is also a mate of mine, a former Special Forces soldier and Gurkha, who spent his entire life taking on the hardest challenges life can offer you. In the episode, we answer some questions that you've asked me on Instagram. I'm going to be sending a bottle of Talisker to the top question. Here we go. I hope you enjoy the episode. So here he is, the man, the myth, the legend, Nims Di Perger, good friend of mine, and someone who's achieved an awful lot from joining the military, the special forces, and then leaving as well. So, mate, I have like a few obligatory questions, and at this time of, well, not this time of year, during this year, the first question is lockdown. What have you been up to over the last few months, you know, since it's been sort of like wavering in and out of restrictions and then no restrictions, then restrictions again?
Yeah, mate, Fox, is obviously, you know, so good to see you here. Even it's a Zoom meeting, and so glad to be doing this podcast with you, buddy. Yeah, going into your question, you know, fortunately, I should say I have been very, very lucky because I had to write this book, Beyond Possible, and I really didn't realize, you know, how much of a hard work. You have written in a couple of books now and all that. But yeah, you know, most of my time was spent on writing this book, and I just wanted to, you know, give 100%. And, you know, because it's also quite a scary moment, because once you write the thing, it is black and white, and you cannot change that. So, of course, it needs, you know, time, you know, dedication and commitment and all that. So yeah, that's where all my time were kind of, you know, utilized.
Cool, that's awesome. I'm looking forward to the book coming out, actually. I'll look forward to reading it. Also, the common ground there is you've been working with Matt Allen, who writes mine as well, who's a good guy.
Exactly, mate, he's awesome. And then yeah, we've been like, you know, talking and all that, and yeah, it's just good. Cool. Your book is just out as well, isn't it, buddy? You know, so it's just,
yeah, cool. It came out last week. Yeah.
So, well, you haven't sent me one, Foxy, or you want me to pay?
Hey, Do you know what? I've only just got back from Scotland, and I've literally my head's on fire. I've got a box of books, and one of them's got your name on it. Well,
awesome.
It's got my name on it, but it'll have your name on it soon because I'll write in it.
Cool. Yes, brother.
The other issue is, the issue I've got at the moment is the post office here, to go and post something like a parcel, you have to queue up for 2 hours. It's horrendous. So everyone's like, oh, can you send me a book? I'm like, ah, each time I get a different book request, it's a 2-hour wait at the post office queue to go and pack it up and send it on. Anyway, mate, this is all about you. I don't know how we're going to fit in what you've done in an hour. So what we're going to have to do is I will sort of guide us through this hour. And when I think we need to move on to the next bit, that's what we'll do, because otherwise we could be talking for 5 hours and everyone will be asleep. But well, they won't be asleep at the end of it, because it's a pretty awesome story that you've got. Especially, I think last time I spoke to you was only a couple of weeks ago, and you phoned me from some dodgy number in Europe.
Yeah.
Because he was basically, just so everyone knows, Nims has been doing stuff on, what's it called?
It's called speed flying. So yeah, just, you know, coming up.
He's on a parachute with a propeller that propels him along. He did some sort of turn and his phone fell out of his pocket and he broke it, and then yeah. So he's been doing some crazy stuff, breaking phones and that. But mate, take us back to the beginning. What was growing up for you like as a kid? And obviously you grew up in
Yeah, Nepal, in Nepal, Foxy. So it was really humbling, kind of, in upbringing in Nepal. I was born in a really poor family, buddy. But once my brother joined the Gurkhas, which is quite a big thing in Nepal. And after that, they sent me to a bit of, a bit more developed in a town. So Chitwan. So I grew up in Chitwan, which is the most flat and warm part of Nepal. So, yeah.
So ironically, you grew up in the flattest part of Nepal.
Yeah, nothing to do with mountains.
That's bizarre. Did you say your brother was in the Gurkhas?
Yes, mate. I had two brothers and both of them were with the Gurkha infantry. So, yeah. And my dad was in the Gurkhas as well.
Oh, right. Awesome. So it's obviously a family tradition to do the Gurkha thing.
Yeah, mate. It's a big thing for us. So, yeah.
And when did you join up? How old were you when you decided to leave home and join the military?
Yeah, so I was 18 and a half when I, started the selection, Foxy. And if I'm being completely honest, I fell on my first in a Gurkha selection. The DFs, didn't really like me. He's just like, yeah, So, but I made it on the second attempt. And that was when I was 18 and a half. And from, Nepal, and back to Katrick in England, doing, our, basic infantry training. So, yeah.
What is that journey like, joining the Gurkhas? Because it's a bit of a mystery to the rest of us British Forces folk, unless we actually, and I've known you for a while now, but I've never really asked you. And there's a lot of mystery behind it, isn't there? Because people think that you travel miles and miles from home to somewhere else in Nepal, and I don't know what the score is. What is the score?
Yeah. So obviously, a lot of things have changed now, Foxy. But in the past, even in my time, there would be one selection in a year, and there's only one selection a year, and normally 30,000 people apply, even more of that in a year. So yeah, a lot of young lads between 18 and a half to 21. Come for the selection from all around the Nepal, from the country, and of course you go and it is really tough selection though, mate, because you can't just only be good, you got to have a bit of luck as well, and it's just super challenging. It's just because of the number as well that people want to join the Gurkhas and all. So
so what was it quite a daunting thing, because obviously you grew up in Nepal, you probably, I'd take it, English is not your strong language at the beginning, and then the next thing you're on a plane and you're flying to the north of England, to Catterick, to learn how to be a soldier in the British Forces. It must be quite a daunting thing it was daunting for me just to travel down to the southwest and join the Marines, but you're traveling across halfway across the world to do the same sort of thing, really.
Mate, I'll tell you one thing for sure. When I flew on the plane from obviously Kathmandu International Airport to England, growing up, I would see my brothers, they would pick they would put the poster of Big Ben, London Eye, when they come in a holiday in Nepal, and I thought I was gonna see one of those. But what happened was, as soon as we came out of the plane, we were obviously pushing this in the coach. It was horrendous weather then. We didn't see anything like that. Then we went to Katrick, which is up north of England. And as soon as we got out, it was the wind is coming from the sideways, and there was nothing like what I had expected. And I was there were only a couple of houses and there were a lot of sheep. And I was like, this is worse than Nepal. I thought I was coming to England. But yeah. But hey, man. Best place to train for sure.
That must have been horrendous, because obviously a lot of young lads, Nepalese guys, want to join the Gurkhas because it's a well thought of force, and rightly so. But also they do it because it's seen as a good opportunity, isn't it?
100%, mate. Yeah.
Yeah, and you come to what you think is a developed country, and you're up north with more sheep than people, and the weather is absolutely horrendous. It must be
mate, it was it was crazy, but good, man. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So then, obviously, you did. How long did you serve in the Gurkhas, mate, before you then went on to do selection?
I served with the Gurkhas for 6 years. I did my first tour with the Gurkha as well as a close support for, you know, 4D Commandos. That's when I kind of knew about the SBS and all that. And the result of working with 4D Commandos was, you know, I came back here, changed my, you know, like the name, you know, for the briefing course, which was up in Heriport, but changed for that to Pool and went from there, buddy.
Yeah, because I remember when you passed, actually. I was still, because what year was that?
It was 2009, mate, December, yeah.
That's right, yeah, because I'd just come back from Afghanistan and we'd heard that there was a Gurkha that decided to come to Pool, and that's like I think you were the first one, weren't you?
Yeah.
And it, like, you know, it just so people know that are listening, you know, the Gurkhas are part of the British Army, and so predominantly the natural course for one to take on selection is to go to the SAS. But Nims decided to do things differently, and he came down to Pool and had an amazing career in the Special Boat Service. But mate, tell us about your time in the SBS. I know obviously what it's like, but
yeah, for a lot of people. Well, it's, you know, as you know, Foxy, you know, it's of course, you know, it's awesome, it's challenging and all, but it's also tough. You know, you're always away. You know, most of the time, and you know, there were like certain time in a year that where you are probably home for like, you know, 30-35 days, and then you all know, and yeah, it's. But, you know, to be honest, what I got from all this, you know, working with the Special Forces was, you know, operating in a very stressful environment, the training that I got, you know, which kind of, you know, I took forward on the big mountains and all. But I think it's just cool, you know, hanging around with, you know, pretty much, I would say, you know, most of the decent blokes, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, you know, wherever you go, you always find, you know, all that and all. But yeah, generally, you know, the guys were good and all that. So yeah, enjoyed it. And moving into the next part of my career, I think. But yeah, overall, it was good.
Mate, have you got any funny stories about anything that happened on tour or anything you can share with us?
But hey, Foxy, you know. You know, we're not allowed to say so much on this one, on this stuff. But yeah, fucking hell. Maybe I think, well, I can definitely tell you one thing. I did this, obviously, you know, like we're doing a jump, and one of the really funny thing, you know, what the guys, you know, find it crazy was, I jump up the aircraft and realize it was a malfunction on my canopy.
Yeah. And so just quickly, well, for people listening, we're talking about a parachuting incident now.
Yeah.
The jump is a parachuting incident. So you've looked up and you've got a malfunction, which is horrendous.
Yeah. So when you get malfunction, what you do is, you know, you straight away, you know, pull the reserve. But what I did was, I thought I was pretty cool and calm, just trying to get, you know, like get that message across. So I just get into the radio and say, all calls. Nims cut away, and then I did the cut away, and obviously lads were taking the piece out of that. But yeah, so many things.
So basically, instead of like just getting on with it and cutting away, you told everyone else what you were going to do, which was,
yeah.
Just to put that into perspective, I would not have cared about the lads and told them anything. I'd have just got on with getting rid of that the crap parachute and pulled out the reserve. So yeah, cool, nice, calm and collected. Mate, I'm going to start moving into the proper crux of what we're here to talk about. Talk to me about mountaineering and when it started for you, because obviously, you know, you grew up in the flatlands of the lowlands of Nepal. So how did it suddenly become a thing for Nims to want to climb mountains, and then not only just want to climb them, become unbelievably good at it?
Yeah, so Foxy, you know, as you just said, you know, I had, you know, no idea or not even thought of, you know, like, you know, climbing any mountains at all. But once I served with the Special Forces, you know, going around the world, of course, you know, I do stand out because, of course, I'm from Nepal. I'm obviously, you know, brown and all that. So people would ask, you know, where are you from? And I would say, hey, I'm from Nepal, you know, the Gurkhas. And they would say, oh, you are from Nepal. Have you, like, climbed Everest? As if, you know, like, every, you know, like, the Nepalese or the Gurkhas, you know, climb Everest. I was like, no. And they would say, have you seen it? I was like, no. at the end, I was just sick of saying no to so many people. So I was like, yeah, at least, you know, let me go and, you know, see, you know, Everest at least. So I went for the trekking kind of, you know, journey to Nepal. I was only 29 years old. And I remember my at that point, as we come through the Namche Bazaar, it's one of the villages, as you go through the Khumbu Valley, beautiful, 3,200 meters. And then we saw a big mountain called Amadablam, which is the most technical mountain in the Himalayas, which I didn't know at that point. And I just asked my guide, I was like, hey, brother, can we climb that mountain, see, you know? And he just laughed at me. He's like, names, people who climb Everest even fails on that mountain. But anyway, I just wanted to feel like, you know, how it feels to reach to the summit of a peak and all that. So I eventually convinced the guide that, you know, take me to one mountain at least. So I remember my, we were wearing crampon and walking in the grass. He was teaching us like, okay, this is how you should be, you know, walking with the crampons and all that. And yeah, eventually managed to climb in a 6,200 meter peak. Yeah, I was really, you know, kind of, you know, late in the year of my career. I was 29 years old. But mate, it started from there and I never looked back.
What, were you in the Gurkhas then or were you in the Special Forces?
I was in Special Forces, buddy, yeah, in Pool. Yeah.
It's quite late to start to introduce yourself to the mountains, especially, you know, most people be like, oh, Nims is a Gurkha. I bet he climbed Everest when he was 10 and all this sort of thing. you were 29. What was that mountain called, the first one? Can you remember?
It's called Lobuche East, and that's where the beginners, you know, start in at the start of their, you know, mountaineering career and all that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And so that was obviously, do you think, from that first mountain, do you think you were hooked immediately into what mountaineering is?
Yeah, 100% Foxy. And, you know, at that point, you know, when you, like, you know, come from the Gurkha and when you are in the Special Forces, you know, doing, and, you know, you do a lot of stuff over there. And then you kind of also think, you know, you are invincible. Then when I went over there, my everything was like, you know, really, you know, things put, you know, became perspective for me. You know, it becomes very clear that, you know, we are very small and all that. But yeah, it was kind of, you know, that experience. But also when I reached to the summit, man, the view was so amazing. It was still, you know, freezing cold, but the freshness that you can get from that, you know, elevation, it was like crazy. So yeah, and after that I started, you know, doing more and more.
So what was when did you do Everest for the first time? Because okay. I know you've done it a few times and you've got put the project possible thing to one side a minute. Already done Everest a few times and you've already got a few world records. So
yeah,
let's talk about the first time and then talk about your journey with Everest going forwards.
Cool. All right. So my first Everest was in 2016. It was completely unplanned. I had no idea whatever I was going to, like, even thought of doing it. But what I had done was, you know, folks, I just came from one tour and I was meant to be going on another tour. It was back to back. And I was expecting that, you know.
That's tours of duty in the Special Forces for people.
Yeah.
Go on, sorry.
Yeah. So I had just came from one and I was supposed to be going on the other one. And then what happened was, you know, out of a sudden, I was supposed to be getting only 3 weeks leave, but I got 4 weeks and I was like, and bear in mind, I had planned to go on a holiday with my wife, you know, initially and all that. But then when they give me 4 weeks, I was like, I cannot just go on a beach and just like chill out and do nothing. And I was just looking for what can I do. And then Everest expedition was happening at that same point. The only problem was I had no money. And the other problem was I was like 1 month behind than the rest of the season's mountaineer. So I was like, one, can I do it? You know, two, like, okay. If I go and fail, you know, there's a massive, you know, reputational risk as well. Anyway, long story short, you know, you can find more on the book, but I decided to go to Everest, you know, climbed it very, very quick and rescued a climber from 8,450 meters. So basically this girl, Sima Goswami, she was left, you know, behind by her guides, by her team. And yeah, and of course, you know, I couldn't walk past her. So I rescued her down and it's still obviously, nobody knew who I was and all that, but within 4 days of, you know, summiting Everest, I was in operations, in a kicking door. So yeah, that was my first Everest expedition.
But you brush over it quickly, but it's mental, because basically just to put it into perspective, Nims was on leave from doing one tour of Afghanistan in the Special Forces and decided he wasn't going to go on holiday with his wife, who he's still married to, and I don't know how. But he was going to basically... How did you get the money to go and do the...
Mate, you're right. So I went to the bank and I told, obviously, them, I need a 15K to buy a car. So they gave me a 15K loan. I still remember it was 3.99% interest rate. And yeah, emptied my saving and everything. So yeah.
So Nims took himself to Nepal, basically emptied the bank, thinned his missus out for a holiday and went climbing. And in the process ended up rescuing someone. And all this whilst on leave from the SBS. And he was actually not allowed, theoretically, you're not allowed to travel. He's supposed to stay in the country and just sort of like chill out and not do things that are too dangerous, because you're seen as an asset to the strategic capability of the British Special Forces. But anyway, so that was your first trip up, and you rescued the young lady that was basically left there to die, wasn't she?
Yeah, mate. So yeah, now she's back home. You know, she's alive with her family and all that.
How did that rescue go?
That was so tough. You know, at first I thought I wasn't, you know, I wasn't sure because it was my first time. Then as soon as, you know, I started cracking on, you know, like where you go into operational mode, you know, like Foxy, you know, you just, you know, get on with it, isn't it? So, yeah. And just to give you an example, mate, how fast I rescued her, it only took me 90 minutes to rescue from 8,450 meters. To 7,950 meters. It's like almost 500 meters at the death zone.
Yeah.
And for those who doesn't understand, to explain you the scale of the rescue. Once I brought her down to camp 4, I gave it to the rescue team members, and there were like five of them, and they took 2 days to bring, like, you know, her from camp 4 to camp 2. So, you know, see you can kind of, you know, relate how tough it would be.
So how did you get her down to those other guys?
You on what? The rope and dragged it down.
Just dragged her down.
Yeah, yeah.
So you were at what height was she at?
8,450 meters. So that's like way, you know, in the death zone. I think there are only four mountains above, you know, 8,000 meter peak in that height.
So you were I think you summited that on your own, didn't you?
Yeah.
On that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were sat on the top of Everest on your own, weren't you, taking in the view for a bit?
Yeah, I was there, mate. It was super, like, you know, cold. I was, because we reached the summit, you know, a bit in the dark. So at this point, I had a very, like, young, you know, climbing, you know, buddy. So he had never climbed Everest. He was a porter. But I just wanted to give him an opportunity. So from next time, he could, you know, earn more.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, he kind of, you know, got scared as soon as the wind picked up. So he left me from the summit, and I said, yeah, fine, and you can go down. So I stayed for a bit longer. And yeah, it was a bit crazy though, man. You know, like, yeah.
So then obviously, okay, so you've dragged her off. Were people asking who you were? And obviously, were you worried about the fact that you were in the Special Forces and you were worried that you might get bubbled a little bit on?
Yeah, but you picked it up. So what had happened was, when I rock up at the Lukla, which is the gateway to this, you know, big mountains, that was a month behind, and I was, you know, obviously in this tea house, and the guy who was the director and also producer of this biggest rescue, you know, filming that was going on, he happened to be sat next to me, and he's like, hey, what are you here for? You here for the trekking? And I was like, no, I'm here for the expedition. And then he asked me, do you know you are like a month behind? Everybody's now waiting for the summit push almost. And I was like, yeah, I know. And he asked me what you do for a living. And I said, I work as a paramedic in Royal London. I'll pause that part here, Foxy. So when I went over there, summited and did all the rescue, my friend kind of know, like, because everybody were like, who's this guy? So my friend dropped the S-bomb. So soon, you know, in the base camp, you know, people knew who I was and all that. And then there were like loads of like media requests. But how I got away with that was, like, I said to them, look, you know, I'm a serving member of UK Special Forces. If I get out on a press or any news or anything else, I'm going to lose my job. And if you want me to lose my job and my pension for, you know, for the rescue I did, you know, you do that, guys. But, you know, if you think, you know, it's genuine and if you want to protect my job and all, do not write anything. Do not talk about anything. And then everybody screw the knot now over there, mate. But, yeah, people kind of, you know, like internally knew about it.
So that was, so basically you sort of like basically called them out and you were honest with them, but said, don't write anything. And it's good that they didn't. Mate, you came back. What, tell us about the next sort of time with Everest.
Because then you started. Yeah, Foxy, you know, 2017, the Gurkhas were back again trying to climb Everest. So this was a big mission for the British military. The Gurkhas were trying to, you know, climb Everest in order to, you know, tribute the respect to the Queen and Crown for serving more than 200 years with the British military. So 2015, the expedition, you know, got failed because massive earthquake was over there. So many people were, you know, like got killed and all that.
Yeah.
So, you know, fortunately, you know, the Gurkha Everest expedition team was lucky. So nobody, you know, died in 2015. There were some, you know, some injuries and all that. So 2017 was in a kind of, you know, going back there to complete the incomplete mission. So I was one of the instructor over there. And what happened was the highlight of 2017 was normally on Everest, there will be a fixing team. And then the job of the fixing team is like they would go up, set the fixed lines, you know, before in hand, so that the rest of the mountaineers, like they would, you know, obviously put the handjumar and then they would climb.
Yeah.
So 2017, the fixing team couldn't set the fixed lines to the summit, and I was like, wow, okay, you know, what does that mean to me and then to us? And I was like, as everyone else, when you say you are a Gurkha and people think Everest is in your back garden, and being as a Gurkha and not being able to climb Everest, I felt like there was a huge reputational risk. And then second cause was like, when we ever gonna get another chance, which will be like the third attempt to climb Everest.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Using, you know, British taxpayers' money. So the answer was no. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to have to step up. So I step up and I said, look, I'm going to set the fixed lines. And everyone was like, who is this guy? Obviously, people didn't know. So yeah, but, you know, we had like a bunch of, you know, Sherpas and all. And the first time, the Sherpas and Gurkhas kind of, you know, work together, and we set the fixed lines not only for our team but, you know, for the rest of the season's mountaineer, and that's what it actually, you know, made the whole expedition successful. Yeah, and the story goes on there. So I got back down to base camp and then back to Kathmandu. We partied with the boys and all, and after that, you know, I had a secret mission, which was to, you know, climb Everest, Lhotse, and Makalu in the fastest, you know, time possible. Which I had planned around 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But long story short, I went up again after, you know, having a massive celebration and partying with the boys. Then I climbed Everest again, then Lhotse and Makalu in just 5 days. And that's like stopping for 2 days in Namche Bazaar, which is like, you know, the kind of, you know, like
the capital
of Kumbu Valley to party for 2 days. Otherwise, I could have done that in 3 days. And that's when I realized, wow. And at the end, and when I was at the Makalu, which is the world's fifth highest mountain, after climbing these three mountains in 5 days, I was at the base camp waiting for the helicopter to come and pick me up. But yeah, the weather was so bad, and the helicopter couldn't come. And what I did was I decided to run. So I run from base camp to the road end, which normally takes, you know, 6 to 8 days worth of trekking, depending upon the fitness. And, you know, I did with my team, but only out of four, only one made it with me. And I finished that whole journey in just 18 hours after climbing all those big mountains. And that's when I realized, okay, I think I have got something.
You think you have something. So did you get a record on that occasion?
Yeah, so I got the record. I got three world records, but you know, one of the good one was, you know, climbing Everest, Lhotse and Makalu in 5 days.
Yeah.
You know, and the other one was, you know, climbing Everest and Lhotse in just 10 hours 15 minutes. And that record was, you know, broken super super accidentally, man. I didn't even knew like there was a record. Apparently the previous record was 20 hours and I just broke by half.
That's awesome. So do you think, is that when the Project Possible was born in your head?
Yes, you are right, buddy. So after that, I got back into pool and I was in the mountain troop. So, you know, I was kind of put in charge of, you know, mountain rep in the service. And the first thing I proposed the pool was, hey guys, since I'm here, you know, like, you know, my job is to, you know, go out, you know, like develop my skills, find out what's out there and pass on to the blokes. I just need 80 days off, but in these 80 days, I'm going to go and climb top five highest mountain in the world. And it's like in Everest, K2, Kanchenjunga, Lhotse and Makalu. At first, you know, like the service was excited, but then they realized it's such a huge risk. And unfortunately, you know, they couldn't, you know, take the risks.
Yeah.
Which then made me decide to leave the pool. So, yeah.
So you left, because of wanting to do Project Possible. So
100%.
When did it turn into, instead of it being the five highest mountains, when did it turn into the 14? 8,000 meter plus mountains.
Yeah. So Foxy, I put my notice in. I realized that I was like, yeah, I don't need to have time frame now. You know, I'm my own boss. I have got 1 year free if I can do that. So I started looking into it. Like, why climb only like five mountain? You know.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna climb all the Death Zone peak, and I just need probably 7 months to do it. So yeah, I just went full in.
You went full in. I mean, I knew about it when you were sort of planning it. Obviously we'd met each other and bumped into each other and we were chatting. And then I remember I came to the Nepalese embassy in London with you for your presentation. And that was where I think you had the backing of the Nepalese government, but you know, raising funds was difficult, wasn't it?
Yeah. You know, I think that the hardest part of this whole mission was, you know, the funding, because, you know, no one would really believe that it is possible. And when people like, okay, the previous, you know, record is nearly 8 years. How are you going to do that in 7 months? You know, and yeah, it was really hard. But you know, I kind of, you know, felt like as soon as I go and start, you know, climbing this mountain in the manner and you know, style that I have said I would do it, I was just hoping that, you know, people will support this, and it will take only 1 million people to just give £1, and the project would be funded. And I had that kind of, you know, vision. So. But mate, you know, like, yeah, massive, you know, thanks. You know, you guys came over there and, you know, like the government were trying to support. But yeah, it was kind of, you know, like as soon as I started ticking up boxes and climbing one mountain after another, and there was more crowdfunding, the sponsorship started coming in slowly. And yeah.
Just to put that into perspective for people, obviously NIMS had this, an amazing idea to climb the 14 highest peaks in the world. The last record, or the quickest it had ever been done, was around 8 years, and he was proposing to do it in a season, which is 7 months. And so when it comes to it, there was a lot of interest for people thinking about sponsorship, but then when they looked into it, they were like, this is just absolutely mental, he's probably going to die doing it, so we can't really be seen to fund someone's demise and death. So that's where people bottled it a little bit. But there were people that came through and sponsored you to get it to get the ball rolling, I suppose. How much did it all cost end?
Well, it cost a bit more than expected. The first figure I had put was, you know, around 750K, and it's purely because of, you know, like, you know, the rescue that I did, you know, missing the weather window, and, you know, like the Sisapangma being close to all of us and all that. But hey, yeah.
So
it wasn't a cheap expedition, and that's me doing the expedition in almost a piking style. You know, I didn't have like massive support. I didn't have much, you know, like that. It was just like, you know, bare skin in terms of, you know, the logistical support you would ideally get when you are going for, you know, this, you know, big kind of, you know, like extreme, you know, world record, you know, breaking process or endeavor. But hey.
So what, so anyway, you know, money started to come in. You did a few charity fundraising things. I remember going to see you at the Royal Geographic Society. Yeah. That was really cool. In fact, actually, it was still, you know, this whole thing was quite a pipe dream. And I can remember there was basically NIMS was presenting at the RGS in London. And a lot of us went along, a lot of, you know, guys, we all know him from the service, went along. And I remember there was a Q&A at the end, and this guy, I don't know who it was like that. So what, NIMS, what happens if you don't do it? And it was like, it said something that was, it was a phrase from another planet. NIMS was like, what are you on
yeah,
about?
Yeah, you were saying like, you know, what happens, NIMS, if you can't do it? If you cannot do it in like 7 months, let's say, because of the weather, you know, the climbing is so extreme that, you know, there are so many issues with the weather, the wind speed. Maybe you are good and your team is good, but then the objective danger, the environment, you know, you probably can do in like, you know, 8 months or a year.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know what I said.
Yeah, you're like, nah, what you want? I don't even understand what you're asking me.
Talking of course
about, we can do it.
Yeah, I said, you know, the mission is 14-7. And as soon as I go like 7 months beyond, I found my mission.
We just stopped it there.
It was cool.
It was an unbelievable confidence, but and rightly so, because you actually did it. And how long did it take you in the end?
Did in 6 months, 6 days, buddy. And that's like, you know, guiding people on 3,000-meter peak. And normally if you guide on, you know, 8,000-meter peak, it takes, you know, at least a month to, you know, take people. So a lot of my time were going on that, you know, guiding stuff, because, you know, we didn't have the proper funding. So I was trying to make a bit of money from there for the project. And there were so many political issues, mate, you know. Yeah, it was crazy, crazy stuff going on. Yeah, hence why. But it's still, yeah, 6 months, 6 days, Foxy, there you go.
And what were the first few mountains that you climbed during project?
So I did Annapurna, Dhalagiri, Kanchenjunga, Everest, Lhotse, and Makalu. So I climbed Nepal's 6,000-meter peak in 31 days. And that's when people were like, wow.
Yeah.
And one of the things what it also got the attention for the people was I climbed Everest, Lhotse, and Makalu, which is like the world's first, fourth, and fifth highest mountain in just 48 hours. And that's when people were like, wow. And then that's when, you know, like, you know, the big sponsors started coming in and all that. But yeah.
It was impressive. And you obviously took that iconic photograph as well, which got stolen by the world's media. Everyone queuing up to get up onto the top of...
Mate, that's the problem, isn't it? With this big media and all that, you know, they don't know how hard it is to take the picture up at that elevation. Your fingers are freezing. You have to bother. You got to make that an effort. And then people were just using my image without credibility. And I was like, come on, you know, I'm dying for funding here. At least do some, like, you know, favor, or at least pay for it, you know, maybe whatever it is, there will be funding coming to the project.
Mate, that's a lesson learned there on your part. Don't bang it up on social media.
I also didn't know that it's going to be that famous as well.
Lessons learned, mate. Lessons learned. Anyway, mate, I've got to ask you a few, because obviously, I mean, we can't talk about every single one, because it's just it's an immense story, and your book's coming out anyway, so that's something to look forward to. But I've got to ask about the infamous K2, because it is a killer, isn't it? You know, it's renowned for killing people. It's one of the hardest mountains in the world to climb. So can you just tell us a little little bit about K2?
So yeah, so K2 is, you know, it's called a savage mountain. You know, one in four dies over there, and it's one of the, you know, extreme in 8,000 meter peak. So what happened last year was I was in Pakistan, you know, trying to climb all this in a, you know, 5,000 meter peak.
Yeah.
And, you know, I came like, you know, in the K2 base camp. And what had happened was more than like 95% of the people had already given up because it was so dangerous and it was so, you know, risky. But then there were like 5% of the people who were like, you know, still waiting at the base camp, you know, hoping that, you know, me and my team would come and make this happen. So even though, like, for me, I went to K2 base camp, I was trying to climb the Broad Peak, which is just a neighboring peak. But then when everybody was kind of expecting that, Foxy, you know, you feel like, okay, if I don't do that, you know, you feel like you are kind of, you know, letting their hope die, you know. So I changed my plan to go and set the fixed lines on K2 with my team members. And yeah, it was just a full-on Nepalese team, and we went up and made the impossible possible. And after that, you know, all the people also like submitted to the summit of K2. But the sad part is, Foxy, and I saw like some of the people making like, you know, documentaries and all that from there. And there's no mention of, you know, like me and my team or even like anything. And that's when I was like, come on, you know. But that's the sad part. But yeah, I mean, after that, yeah, summited K2, got to base camp directly, partied pretty much, you know, most of the night. Only had 3 hours slept, went and, you know, finished the final one straight from base camp to the summit. So yeah,
unbelievable, mate. What makes K2 so dangerous? Is it the weather? Is it technical? Is it all of
both, mate? It's both. It's technical as well. It's super steep, and it's also the weather. The weather is unforgiving and all. So yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome. And then obviously, I'd like to talk about the the issue with the Chinese when you were trying to get up. Is it Shishapangma?
So what had happened in Shishapangma was
I can never pronounce it.
The mountaineers like they struggle, mate. So the Chinese government had closed the mountain for everybody else, and they have done in the like in 2018 as well, and they did in 2019 as well. And you know, like how Chinese government are, I mean, they don't listen to anyone. Doesn't matter, even if it's from U.S. government or whatever it is, they do whatever the, you know, like, you know, they want. So, yeah. I mean, for me, I was trying to get this permission. It was so, so hard. And I really felt like if I go through the British Channel, I will not go anywhere else. So I decided to go through the Nepalese one as a neighboring country. And but yeah, I was pulling every string I could in a meeting, like, you know, Prime Minister, you know, Foreign Minister, Tourism Minister, like four or five, you know, meeting with the minister level in a day. But also this is when I kind of realized, you know, the whole project become like people's project, because I had made a post on social media. I was like, look, I have given everything. I don't have anything left. Yeah. Here are the emails for the Chinese authorities. If you can send them a letter or request. And a lot of people, you know, did that as well, you know, Foxy. And I think at the end, you know, Chinese Tibet Mountaineering Association was like, yeah, Nims, we'll give you the permission. And we went over there, and, you know, Shishapangma was, of course, our last mountain. But what we did was, you know, we summited that in style. You know, it was almost like end of autumn, heading towards winter. And, well, the anniversary is in 2 days' time, buddy. Yeah, yeah. So, but we completely opened the new route as well in Shishapangma, you know. So, yeah, it was crazy. Yeah, good. The good crazy.
It's an unbelievable achievement, mate. It really is. And I'm proud to know you. But what do you think the main challenges were mentally and physically through the whole of that project?
I think, It was kind of the mental issues comes in because I had to bother about this fundraising, you know, even when I was climbing. So I had the issues like, you know, the fundraising, the logistical nightmare that I had to plan through, you know, like my mom, who is very close to me, was in a, she almost died, you know, twice.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was, of course, you know, the risks to my life as well, you know, when I was, you know, operating some of the mountainous area, which I have covered in much more in the details. Yeah, you know, like, as you know, Foxy, you know, it was a million things going, you know, at the same time, but what I felt like was, you know, there was no turning back, and I couldn't give up at this stage because, you know, I had the purpose and I had the love for the mountaineering, and I had the purpose of why I was doing it. And those, you know, the love and the purpose and the mission, what it kind of keep me motivated. But I must say, you know, climbing was the most easiest part of all this endeavor. It was like full on.
The bit that everyone thinks is hardest is the bit that you enjoyed and found easiest.
Yeah, man. And I still remember it was so painful, like when you were not sleeping for 19 days, specifically in Pakistan, and you're climbing at night and you are like, just like, you know, every step sometimes you'll fall asleep. And what I used to do was I used to just grab the snow and rub in my face and put them in my armpit just to stay awake and slap myself. It was a torture, mate. And then you can take so much, you know, at some point you were just like, I wish the big avalanche comes and just take me away. Everything, every pain is gone then. And it's not my fault. And yeah, mate, it was next level.
So basically, yeah. You weren't going to give up, but every now and again, this is how mental it is. Every now and again, you were hoping for an avalanche to wipe you out. There we go.
Yeah, and it's peaceful day. It's not your fault.
Yeah. Mate, you did have a team of guys with you. Can you name them? I think it's what they're worth.
Yes, Yeah, of course, mate. Because, you know, with a bigger endeavor like this, you need a solid team. You know. Yeah. And of course, you know, me as a leader, you got to be a team player as well. And if you cannot be a good team player, you can never be a leader. So our team was like, you know, it was unique. You know, even the guys didn't have much experience. There was a, like, you know, kind of a hunger in them as well. And everybody was, you know, fully in. We're like a family. And, you know, I had obviously Mi'kmaq David Sherpa, who is my right-hand man and who have always been, you know, my right-hand man. Then I had Galjen, I had Gisman, I had Lakpa Dendi, I had Dawa, and yeah, so pretty much, you know, like a whole lot of the Nepalese, you know, mountaineering community behind, and now we're like a family, mate. So it's good. It's good to bring that whole team up, and the guys also managed to climb in an 8 peak with me and all that, and it was a completely, you know, next level opportunity for them. What it worked out the most of was Foxy. You know, normally when people climb on these big mountains, they would take someone who have summited that mountain, because, you know, you can see the route, they know the route as well, and it helps a lot. But then what I had done was I had put the guys in the mountain they hadn't climbed before, so it was also something for them as well. And we'd, you know, I was like, well, we're not gonna lost in the mountain, you know, it's like navigation, mate, SF. It's on the ball. So I think that kind of, you know, plan really worked well for all of us. So it's good.
Did you all have a good crack?
Oh, mate, we were like, you know, mate, we were laughing. Of course it was painful, but then we would have, you know, nice parties as and when we could, you know, loads of like dancing.
Yeah, I've seen some of that on social media. It's tough, but it looked awesome. And I'm pleased for all of you. Did you find, I mean, it's a long period of time, we'll sort of wrap up on project possible now, but did you find it difficult being away from the family?
With your mum being the way she was. Yeah, so I have been away for almost a year, I would say, with the training and all that, and then I had a massive support from my wife, and honestly, if it was anybody else, I would have probably been divorced and gone and all that, but yeah, she's been a massive supporter. And the bigger thing is, like, you know, she doesn't really bother me. She knows that I have, you know, my own, like, you know, issues, you know, big problems to go with and all that. So she's been like massive supportive. And even like from like when I said, okay, look, I'm going to remortgage this house, the only house we have, and we're going to put, you know, further funding. So, yeah, but it's been, you know, I have got really good family and all that. Even my brothers, you know, and my mom and dad, you know. Obviously, my mom passed away, but, you know, at that point, you know, she was, you know, with me and all, you know, throughout all this journey. So it's quite nice to have that, you know, backing, buddy.
Yeah, definitely. And it's testament to yourself and to all of your family that have supported you coming away and succeeding in what many people thought was impossible. But you don't know what that word means, do you? So that's a good thing.
Right.
Mate, you've got, we're going to start wrapping it up a little bit, but you have written a book. It's called Beyond Possible. When does it come out?
But it's coming out on 12th of November.
So 12th of November. That's great. In time for Christmas, I expect to see one with my name in it.
It's coming in your way, brother, 100%. Yes.
What do you hope the readers will take away from reading your book?
The biggest thing, you know, what I have, you know, written in the book is not really about just climbing mountains and all that. It's about the journey, the endeavor. Everybody, you know, I believe, you know, they have their own mountains to climb in life. And it's just, you know, the technique, you know, the mindset that I use to overcome the bigger obstacles and stuff. And I think people can relate themselves in this kind of, you know, journey, and then kind of, you know, make it work for them. And just hopefully, you know, they can achieve their, you know, new possible through this. It's for everybody else. So, yeah.
Okay, that's awesome, mate. I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait to read it. And I know, you know, Matt's told me it's good as well. Obviously, he's going to say that because he writes it as well. But I do trust him. He's done some really good books in the past.
Yeah, it's good. It's good, buddy.
Mate, what's next for you? What is the next challenge? Because I know you get bored quickly. So yeah. I know there's something going on.
So, K2 Winter. So K2 is the only mountain above 8,000 meter peak that still remains unclimbed. You know, so many countries have tried to like put their name, like the Russians, the Spanish, the Italian, the French, everybody.
Never been climbed in the winter.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm going there, brother. So I'm going there tomorrow.
Are you?
I'm starting my year. So that's why I'm like full on, man. And I decided to do this last week. So my head has been on fire, and I'm back to where I was like 2 years ago, you know, trying to find the sponsorship, the funding and all that. Not sleeping at night, you know, all that is happening again, buddy. And I was like, why the hell I put myself into same conditions again? I think it's in me, buddy. So yeah, I'm off there.
That's awesome. Good luck, mate. Good luck. Anything else as well once that's cracked?
Mate, after that, maybe we'll see, you know, maybe fly from, you know, 1,000 meter peaks. We see. I don't know. It's,
you know, I know you're setting yourself up for something crazy. I know.
Yeah.
Mate, I tell you what we're going to do now is, obviously, I put out on social media.
Yeah.
I ask people to send in questions that they want me to ask you. And the one that I read out gets a bottle of Talisker, because obviously this is supported by Talisker.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Malt whiskey made by the sea. And so this is by someone on Instagram called Tanya.Verdejo. Okay. Verdejo. Yeah. Her question is, you've achieved some incredible climbing feats, pushing the boundaries of what is possible. In your guiding experience, working with many different people and nationalities, what is the most unusual climbing ritual or superstition you have encountered? Are there any?
Well, I can't think of one, to be honest. That's a good question, but yeah, I can't really. I need to go into.
Are there any? There are climbing rituals and superstitions, though, aren't there? I know the Nepalese are quite superstitious and.
What we believe in, like, you know, in the mountain god, and, you know, before we go and do any big climbs, you know, we do a big puja ceremony, and we basically, you know, pray the mountain god for the safe passes, and all that. But I think every mountaineer, kind of, you know, who have been into the 8,000, they respect that kind of rituals, and we all do because it's a good vibe and it's a good energy and all that.
What do you do on the rituals? What do they consist of?
So basically, you know, you have this, like, you know, a prayer. The prayer flags goes in the directions, and there's a lama, you know, who kind of, you know, sets the prayer up.
Yeah.
And at the end, you know, you end up drinking whiskey and all that.
Happy days. We like climbing rituals. They sound great. Mate, thanks so much. I mean, we could have spent hours going through all of that, but as a look forward for everyone, Nim's Die Persia's book comes out 12th of November, Beyond Possible. It's going to be an awesome read, and you'll be able to find out. It will put a lot more flesh on the bones of this interview. But, mate, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it, and good luck with your trip away starting tomorrow.
Good. Thank you so much, Foxy, mate. Thanks for having me here. I really appreciate it, pal.
Thanks very much to Nims. Hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you don't already, and follow me and the Book of Man for the latest news. Thanks again to Talisca for supporting this podcast, and thanks to you all for listening. Take it easy, and I'll see you soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.